Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in Asian American Studies. I'm Najwa, a postdoctoral scholar in the Society of Fellows at Boston University and your host today. I'm delighted to be joined by Dr. Charlotte Karam Albrecht, an associate professor of American Culture and Women's and Gender Studies at the University of Michigan, Ann Arbor, where she's also a core faculty member for the Arab and Muslim American Studies program and affiliated faculty for the Center for Middle Eastern and North African Studies. We will be discussing her new book, Possible Histories, Arab Americans and the Queer Ecology of Peddling, published by the University of California Press in February 2023. With simultaneous breadth, rigor, and even a bit of scandal, it examines the Syrian peddling economy in the late 19th and early 20th centuries United States, providing archival, cultural, and speculative histories of sexuality within Arab American racial formations. Charlotte, thank you so much for joining me and for sharing your wonderful work with us.
Thank you. Thanks so much for inviting me to be here.
Of course. I'm really excited for this conversation. So let's dive right in.
Okay.
This book starts with a rumor, specifically gossip pertaining to your great-grandfather's sexuality, which you tell us shaped some of the inquiries that would forge your research for this project. So given Possible Histories emerges from and really makes both visible and methodological your own positionality as a historian with particular investments in queer Arab American archives, I'd love to start this discussion with your journey. So may I ask you to introduce yourself and tell us a bit about the path that brought you to this project?
Yeah, of course. So my interest in this project initially came from an interest in my own family history, and I thought of it as a quote-unquote personal interest that was separate from my academic and scholarly interests. And when I started in graduate school, I was in a feminist studies program. I sort of came to a head around this. So just for a bit of context for folks who haven't read the book or aren't familiar with it, I'm a fourth generation Lebanese American on my mother's side. I'm also queer. And I was an undergraduate women's and gender studies major and then did feminist studies. So I knew I was interested in gender and sexuality, and I was always interested in race, you know, whiteness, anti-blackness. And then there was this kind of like conundrum for me about where do Arabs fit in this? Because I didn't know. I had maybe my own personal experience and some thoughts about family, but I didn't even know that there was a field of Arab American studies that existed. And I didn't even really have a sense that my own family's story was embedded in a larger, you know, transnational history of migration and affiliation and kinship and labor and so on, right? Mm-hmm. So it wasn't until I was in graduate school and a couple of people really encouraged me to pursue it as a serious kind of scholarly inquiry that things started to shift. And one of those people, you know, actually knew of Sarah Gualtieri's work and introduced me to her work. And, you know, that really gave me a framework for, you know, questions that I might want to ask, right? Mm-hmm. What kind of project might this look like coming out of feminist studies, coming out of queer studies? But initially, I was pretty focused on race, not as separate from sexuality and gender, but I just didn't know how it would look in the project. I was just really preoccupied with trying to understand how this particular set of Arabs, Syrians as they were called at the time from the Levant, were positioned and were positioning themselves in the landscape of US racial norms, white supremacy, and anti-blackness. And it wasn't until I started to think about the labor of peddling and the figure of the peddler that I started to see where sexuality especially came into play. Mm-hmm. I could always sort of see gender, but I really wasn't sure initially how I wanted to articulate the interest in sexuality and how I could articulate where sexuality was in the archives that I was looking at. So mm-hmm. it took a lot of sort of turns to get to that place. Also initially I was, you know, because I was coming from this place of feminist epistemology, thinking about your own position and your own relationship to research and the things mm-hmm. that you study. Initially I was really focused on the self and studying my own family. And it didn't take long for me to change course because, for one, it's just can be very messy and very emotionally taxing. And I also wanted to tell a story that wasn't just about my family or me, because there's not one person or one family that's going to be representative of a history anyway. So, but there were a couple of kind of flashpoints in my family's history that still provided this like really important entry into the work that I kept mm-hmm. and included. And one of those is the preface, which I know we'll talk about a little bit more.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Yeah, I'd love to return to this question about positionality in a bit, because I think your mm-hmm. book is a really gorgeous demonstration of how we can and perhaps should be thinking about our own orientation to our subject matter. But let's sort of lay out the architecture of the book a bit more mm-hmm. for our listeners. So you give us really sort of rich analyses, archives, and theories, but at its core, this book argues for the centrality of sexuality to understanding race, and particularly early Arab racialization in the U.S. So you use, as you said, the figure and social economy of the peddler as both example of, and perhaps even constitutive to, the gender-sexual racialization of Arabs in the U.S., So for listeners who may be unaware of Arab American history, why focus on the figure of the Syrian peddler? And how does the peddler make visible gender and sexuality as lived and lasting modalities for the racialization of Arab Americans?
Yeah, so before I explain, answer that part of the question, I just want to explain like who peddlers were and what they did for mm-hmm. people who might be unfamiliar. They were essentially traveling salespeople. Mm-hmm. Peddlers could be stationed with a cart in an urban area and move around not very much throughout the day. They could be someone who leaves in the morning and goes to the outskirts of a city and comes back at night. They could be someone that travels into more rural areas and is gone for weeks or months at a time. So there's a lot of different types of peddlers, mm-hmm. but it was a really quick way for Syrian immigrants to find work and start making money quickly. You didn't need to know much English. There was already there was like a network of Syrians and especially importers that were setting up Syrians with packs and with goods to sell and connecting them with other people who peddled that would help them with routes and things like this, right? So it was like, you know, a pretty easy network and an employment structure for people to tap into. Mm-hmm. And it could be really difficult work. Some people did not make much money and others made, you know, money fairly quickly that they were able to send home or mm-hmm. use for their own purposes in the United States. So, but the reasons that I ended up focusing on the peddler, there's a few of them. So the first is because I noticed that there was just such prominence of the figure of the peddler and of stories of peddling in Arab American history, both in sort of community colloquial tellings of that history and in formal and more scholarly narratives. So there were connections to popular knowledge. There was connections pretty explicitly to gender and class, because most of those stories were of men who peddled. Most of those stories were about a kind of narrative of accessing wealth pretty quickly. And then another reason is because the encounters that Syrian peddlers had with non-Arab Americans as customers, they were, you know, highlighting these kind of racial differences and Orientalist fantasies that existed about Syrian peddlers. And they also highlighted the range of experiences that Syrians could have with regard to race in the United States. There were, you know, stories popular in popular culture that I talk about in the first chapter, especially about Syrian men, that really discussed these kinds of sexualized both fantasies and fears about Syrian men as peddlers, that, you know, seemed to me to be doing a kind of work about this really small group of people, that there wasn't necessarily a kind of like looming, you know, image in the national imaginary of Arabs as a racial type. But there was a lot of racial work being done, and that racial work was really heavily intertwined with ideas about sexuality and gender. And I saw that most visibly through the figure of the peddler. And there are a couple more things. I mean, one is that the work of peddling was inherently a work of mobility, of transience. And throughout the period that I'm looking at, there, you know, were established links between mobility and transience and non-normative sexuality. So just to, you know, highlight other folks who've done a lot of work on this, Margot Kanaday's book, The Straight State, Nyan Shah's book, Stranger Intimacies, both highlighting, discussing in different ways relationships between transience and sexuality and race. And you know, it also helped for me to understand the differences in how that sort of shadow of non-normativity was cast on women versus men, right? For men, it was really about a kind of quote unquote, you know, deviant sexuality links with homoeroticism and homosexuality and the implications for being racialized as non-white. And for women, it was especially also about being racialized as non-white, but for women especially, it was about a kind of deviant heterosexuality, right? Links with sex work and things like that. So this was another reason that site, I think, was particularly rich for me to explore this. And the final one was more explicitly about my interest in queer studies and in methods, is that I saw this as a place where there were possibilities opened up to imagine queer connections and intimacies beyond what archival collections have recorded, right? Because peddlers, especially peddlers who were going long distance, going, you know, away for more than a day at a time and were having to sleep away from home, there was a separation from their families and their communities and the sites where there may have been the most kind of like policing or the most kind of sense of, you know, sort of stakes or tension around gender and sexuality in the United States for them as an immigrant community. And peddling also increased women's economic autonomy, right? Which might have had, you know, which did have other implications for women's both gender and sexuality in the United States. So I saw sort of a lot of different areas for analysis in this site of inquiry, and for thinking about like what kind of method I wanted to do and what did I want to say about, you know, queerness in Arab American history.
So I would love to move on to that point. Mm-hmm. And I have to add, particularly for those of us who are teachers and looking to fill our ethnic studies syllabi, there's a very sort of useful archive and analyses of the sexual politics of U.S. sort of American Orientalism, mm-hmm. which, as we know, manifests quite distinctly from European formations of Orientalism. Mm-hmm. So thank you for laying that out for us. And so let's break down one of these kinds of rich theoretical apparatuses that you've introduced. So you conceptualize the queer ecology of peddling very capaciously. So it's a multi-skilled and interconnected labor structure, a simultaneously transient and intimate social world, a gendered sexual and racial system, and a historical reading practice. So I'm sure we'll continue to touch on each of these facets throughout the conversation, but do you mind broadly introducing the concept to our listeners? And how does a queer ecological approach to peddling shift the historical narrative? So both popular and disciplinary approaches, mm-hmm. As you've started talking about, to the Syrian peddler in U.S. history.
Yeah. I mean, most broadly, the queer ecology of Syrian peddling allows me to name this kind of multivalent function that peddling takes in the project. So thinking about peddling as a queer ecology, it's a way to expand the understanding of the labor involved in the peddling economy. So traditionally, peddling is not talked about as an economy. It's talked about something that an individual person does, that one peddler, or especially with the advent of Alixa Naff's work, the economy of peddling is about a supplier, right? And the peddlers who go out. And what I noticed in looking through these archives is that peddling was sustained not just by a supplier, not just by, you know, fellow peddlers where you'd, you know, split up routes or travel together for safety or things like that, but by all these other economic activities that were particularly undertaken by women that were really sustaining the whole endeavor and making it profitable for the community. So one of those things was just that some of the things that peddlers were selling were things made by Syrian women in their homes, right? Like embroidered, you know, dust caps and pillowcases and things like that, that were not necessarily being done in a factory. Some of them were just doing them on their own, home industries, as they would be called, right? And this was something that Syrian women could do and still do all these other forms of domestic and reproductive labor that they were expected to do in the home. Another form of labor that I saw again and again in the archive was the operation of boarding houses where Syrian peddlers were staying. And sometimes those were operated and run by women as well. And then finally, just the domestic labor of caring for other people in the family and the community, especially children and older folks who were going to be at home when peddlers left. Right. Mm-hmm. So, and this is regardless of whether or not the peddler, the gender of the peddler who left, right? All that labor still had to be done at home. Those things had to be made for peddlers to sell, and peddlers needed places to stay. Especially, you know, there are peddlers that would basically come to, after like a week, come to another major place where they would stay in a boarding home, like on the weekend, right? Mm-hmm. So it expands our understanding of the labor involved and highlights the significance of women's contributions to this economy. I talk about it as a queer analytic because it also allows for an excavation of the raced, gendered, sexual, and classed implications of the transactional nature of peddling. I've talked a little bit about that, but just the kinds of exchanges between peddlers and customers that came up, the fraught nature of those exchanges, the potential for violence in those exchanges, some of that which was actualized, which I do discuss in the book as well. Similarly, the raced, gendered, sexual, and classed implications of the production and transmission of knowledge about Arab American pasts. So because the project has both thematic and methodological interventions, the queer ecology of peddling is a framework that is flexible enough to encompass both of those things, right? So thinking about what's happening in the history itself, what new ways do we need to be thinking about this history? What have we maybe not seen before when we've looked at peddling or looked at Arab American history writ large? And also, how have we produced knowledge about this history? What have those narratives been? What is the kind of like, you know, meta knowledge about that history that's that we've gotten from other, you know, stories that have been told about this? And particularly, what are the racial and sexual implications of that? So, you know, what I say in the book is that, you know, I say I'm peddling a different history, leaning on the possibility of, on the rubric of possibility to center sexuality and gender without the assumption or expectation of heteronormativity. My use of the queer ecology of peddling as an analytic uncovers a history of Arab American engagements with and investments in whiteness that are simultaneously engagements with and investments in heteronormative sexual politics. So that's really the sort of crux of what I wanted to do, is to show all of these moments where we can see resistance to whiteness or an investment in whiteness or an attempt to sort of claim whiteness or be claimed by whiteness. There's always a heteronormative sexual politics that's sort of looming there, right? That's either being threatened by that or that has to be instrumentalized in order to gain that kind of access.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. So thinking about where you just ended, the politics of whiteness in relationship to Arab racialization. Mm-hmm. So in many ways, this book is about sort of the making of Arab Americans. And Arab racialization is very popularly theorized as a kind of liminal category in U.S. ethnic studies. So characterized, for instance, as in between white and black, or as conditionally white, or at times honorary white. But how Arabs were racially governed and socialized was not only very muddied, but also very situated in relation to religion, class, region, etc. So through the kind of mobile peddling economy, your analyses reveal how these nuances emerge particularly across U.S. regions. And I think this is a particularly exciting contribution of your book, that your archives take us from the so-called frontier West, where settler colonial nation building, itself a sexual and racial project, is expanding, and in which Arabs are variously participating. So you describe peddlers as quote, threatening to white settler heteronormativity, which echoes what you just shared with us before. And then you take us to the urbanized, socially mobile New England communities of Syrian social reformers who want to discipline peddling themselves. So given this kind of breadth, but also specificity of your archives across the U.S., across these kinds of regional politics and class politics, I'd love to think spatially about race and sexuality. What does the queer ecology of peddling reveal about how gendered sexual, class, and regional politics really shape racial citizenship?
Yeah, I mean, I would say that it reveals how unstable Arab American racial citizenship has been and continues to be. You know, one of the things that's helpful looking at a site like peddling, and it's not, you know, I didn't focus on one region. I sort of took examples from all over the place. It contextualizes this kind of variation that characterizes early Arab American racialization. So not just meaning that, you know, it was in between white and non-white, right? Or the honorary whiteness, or these other, I think, very useful and still very accurate concepts that have been theorized, but that the racialization was dependent on the regional context, dependent on the particular situation in which a Syrian was navigating U.S. racial norms, dependent on, you know, religious context and dynamics, all of these different things, and that it could change, right? It could not just changing across Syrians and individuals, but or changing across geographies or regions, but changing for a single person depending on those different kinds of contexts. So, for instance, in the book, I discussed the example of this one Syrian man who was peddling, who's relatively new to the country. And this is all based on news articles, right? So we have to sort of think about the sensationalism of that too. Mm-hmm. But one of his customers apparently accused him of sexually assaulting her, right? Mm-hmm. And there's not details about what occurred or what was alleged. But the white locals in this particular county in Oklahoma where this took place, they were angry, and the police there were afraid that the Syrian peddler would be lynched. So the police moved him to another county where he had relatives so that he would be safer. So in this one story, you have both this kind of, you know, clear, like non-white racialization in which there's this, especially in the narrative about the story, right, this kind of fear of a kind of, you know, dangerous sexual predator, mm-hmm. and in which this person is also benefiting from this protection of white supremacy, where you have these police saying, no, this is someone we should protect. Maybe we know his relatives over here, right? Maybe mm-hmm. there's people we trust already. And so we're going to protect him and move him some other place. So many things that, you know, many other folks would not have that kind of protection. Right. Mm-hmm. So even in one place, it could vary, I think, that much as well. But you have, you know, in the instance of, you know, the kind of what I think you called nation building, settler colonial nation building, in these areas where, you know, the U.S. was actively acquiring and stealing and developing native lands and getting especially white settlers to move to them, you know, mm-hmm. peddlers were really useful for settlers who were moving there. But these links between transience and sexual non-normativity and the ideas about race within them, they weren't something that were desired for a citizen of those territories, right? So for mm-hmm. someone to be assimilated into that kind of context, they needed to stop peddling, mm-hmm. right? And you see a very different context, but a similar kind of impulse in the Northeast, in these social work, social welfare contexts where for women, especially to become proper women, to be understood as proper women, which was to be understood as a white woman, mm-hmm. They needed to stop peddling, right? They needed to cease labor outside the home. They needed to cease labor that was paid inside the home. Mm-hmm. So there's this kind of contradiction in how peddling has been, you know, framed as this kind of like pioneering activity that's so, you know, emblematic of this kind of romanticized early Arab American history, where it was, you know, something that we could sort of look back on and see, oh, that must have been exciting. And they were just, you know, like staking out on their own and making something of themselves. And, but in order to sort of complete that kind of, you know, really capitalist, white supremacist, heteronormative mm-hmm. narrative of mobility, right? They had to stop, right? It had to become something else. And that's not really emphasized, right? It's like those things are sort of recast as emblematic of peddling itself, right? It's mm-hmm. entrepreneurial and it's capitalistic and it's, you know, a feature of really being made for America, right? In all of these mm-hmm. ways. But at the time, that's not actually how it was seen by many people.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I mean, the other thing to think about is that we have so many examples in Arab American history of Syrians who seem to be accepted by white people or to like, quote unquote, become white themselves, mm-hmm. Or all these sort of stories about relationships to whiteness and relationships to white privilege. And because of how the labor and the interactions and discourse surrounding peddling relied on those kinds of ideas that interwove class, religion, gender, sexuality, race. I think, you know, looking at this queer ecology of peddling, it allows for more explicit highlighting of how any one Syrian's ability to access whiteness depended heavily on white American notions of heteronormativity, right? Mm-hmm. And specifically American notions of the sexual normativity. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and that's both in the realm of symbolic or cultural citizenship, but mm-hmm. also thinking about legal citizenship, the, you know, slew of racial prerequisite cases that happened in the early 20th century, where immigrants from the Asian continent argue that they should be considered white in order to gain naturalization. Mm-hmm. Those arguments really relied on familial, reproductive, and as a result, sexual normativity mm-hmm. to shore up evidence of the petitioner's whiteness. So there was like, you know, there was not one without the other. They went hand in hand. And I think that's something that I really tried to demonstrate in the book.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much. Yeah, I appreciate also that so many of your analyses also really productively place Arab American studies in conversation with both settler colonial and indigenous studies. Mm-hmm. Particularly in this way in which you've discussed the kind of route from the transient to the settler as being, I think, a racial and a sexual one, as mm-hmm. you put it.
Yeah, thank you.
So let's move to your archives a bit more, which is also the subject of a really powerful kind of meta-narrative about Arab American historiography within your analysis. I think, as you put it earlier, the kind of meta-knowledges of these histories. So you're largely drawing from the research and archives of one prominent Arab American scholar, Alexa Naf, while using the kind of political conditions and motivations of that archive to critique the historical assumptions of Arab American studies. So can you tell us a bit about the archival politics of Arab American history and how archives themselves reflect and in some cases suppress the politics of race and sexuality?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Alexa Naf, for those not familiar with her, was a historian and did all of these oral histories with first and second generation Syrian Americans, mm-hmm. first in the 1960s and then again in the 1980s. And she had other projects that she did as well. And out of that came her book, Becoming American, The Early Arab Immigrant Experience, where she focuses on peddling. And, you know, is really, I think, the person that has just, you know, she just did this really rich social history of peddling. And in that process, all of these people donated family papers, documents, photos, artifacts, all of these things. So she just, you know, had this huge collection that she that's now at the Smithsonian, right? And so there's so many things about this period of Arab American history and about peddling in particular there. So it's hard not to write. I don't think you can really write about peddling and the peddling economy and not contend with both the archive that she helped to shape and her scholarship that really produced the singular narrative that we've had about the significance of peddling in this sort of early Arab immigrant experience, as she calls it, and its relationship to assimilation that she writes about, right? So I think, you know, one of the things that I noticed is that there were moments in which sexuality seemed to be present, but not visible. Like there might be an anecdote about some kind of misunderstanding that was about a kind of like some, you know, a sexual joke that wasn't meant to be sexual, but somebody else took it as sexual, right? And it would be in the archive, it might be in her book. But there wasn't really any kind of exploration of the significance of that other than, oh, this is a cultural misunderstanding, right? Mm. And she was really interested in gender and really interested in the perspectives of women. Mm. And I think the perspectives of people who were single and unmarried, but you know, it didn't extend to any kind of like curiosity about sexuality to a large extent. And it's both something that I tried to take seriously as like, what are the limits of this? What does this do? What does this produce in terms of the stories that we can tell and the knowledge that we have from this archive? And how can I not expect various things of someone that I don't know, right? And I have a different research agenda. Mm-hmm. And I'm also incredibly indebted to, both for her scholarship and for the archive itself. So that was sort of like the like container for it all. And then I was thinking about how, and you know, other people who have written about this, I especially really like the way Emma Perez writes about this, about ethnic histories, writing their, you know, writing the ethnic history to appeal to sameness, to the white audience. And so you can see that happening in both the things that people deem as being important or as representative of them or their families that they want to collect. This maybe has happened with people who've curated and collected items of, you know, what things that they think should be included and shouldn't. And that people, especially in the time that NAAF was doing these oral histories, the late 60s, right, and the 1980s, that people were very aware of this kind of the rise of this really racist image of the Arab and the Muslim and the U.S. national imaginary. And so the desire to counter that with telling a history, right? Telling a historical narrative or giving things that were going to sort of document the history are always going to be involved in that. And because we know that like this is related to white supremacy and Orientalism and sexuality and gender are so intimately intertwined with that. As a result, one of the things you get is this kind of, you know, excising of gender and sexual non-normativity. So this is, you know, especially early on, I think I also just felt really angry about it, honestly, as like a queer Arab American to say, I know that this is not all we have, right? Mm-hmm. But I had to really think about why this is how things were being constructed, right? And you can really see it in how peddling was discussed in print media in the US especially by non-Arab sources, right? Mm-hmm. Where there are just all of these ideas about this kind of dangerous but also seductive, exotic figure, the figure selling, you know, these exotic goods, but also sort of selling themselves and selling himself, right? Mm-hmm. And ideas that were circulating about women peddlers, because, you know, peddlers in other communities were not women, that people were really trying to counteract these things as like, you know, as discourses that really had material harm attached to them for their communities.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. So I'd love to continue with this question of history and also sort of what the kind of limits and possibilities of archives, as well as your own kind of encounter with the archive. Your analysis is certainly an interdisciplinary one, from archival history to cultural studies. But perhaps we can talk about one or two of your methods that are maybe less customary in history, but that you compellingly insist on within the book, drawing from queer, Black, and post-colonial approaches to history. So one which we touched on at the beginning of the conversation is the work of gossip. So how might gossip generate a method? And second, and possibly in relation, can you discuss what you call historical grounded imaginaries in narrating possible Arab American histories?
Yeah. So one of the kernels to the project, is the one that starts the book in the preface, is this gossip that has surrounded my late great-grandfather's life. He was rumored to be queer. And the rumor is that, you know, long before my time, supposedly he was beat up for cruising for sex with men. And the rumor circulates in my family, but especially to queer family members, like when they first sort of disclose to other people that they're queer. That is what happened to me. That's what's happened to a couple other family members that I know of. And, you know, just generations afterward, it still is knowledge that circulates. It's also knowledge that people outside of the family have and has circulated as a form of, as like a kind of, you know, negative mark against the family, right? And there's people that, that, you know, have a lot of shame about it because of the ways that it's been weaponized against family members. So, you know, I tried to verify whether or not this was true and what actually happened. I wasn't able to, but despite that, I knew that there was this historical significance to the rumor itself. So, probably because I was not trained in a history department, I didn't feel limited to specific methodological boundaries. And, you know, I teach in Arab American studies. I have a lot of Arab American students at my university and in my classes. And gossip continues to be a very powerful mechanism that communicates what's permissible with regard to gender and sexuality in Arab American communities, right? So there's something really important there. So I decided to take gossip seriously as a historical fact and as a historical process. And I found it show up in other places as I was doing archival research. So I saw it show up in multiple places in case records of the Syrian American social worker who noted that women, Syrian women that she was working with, feared the gossip of other Syrians. This happened especially with a woman who'd had a child out of wedlock. And when she saw a Syrian woman come in, the social worker come into the hospital room, she just freaked out, right? She's like, everybody's going to know. And I saw it come up in the pages of Arab American periodicals where editors and community members implied that Syrian women peddlers were dishonorable and were linked with sex work. So it's, you know, it was circulating as a kind of disciplinary mechanism, something that I ended up calling a form of community self-policing, particularly related to gender and sexuality, especially affecting women. So the content of gossip doesn't have to be factual for the lessons and the disciplinary nature of it to be historically meaningful. And that's something that I tried to focus on. And I also wanted to think about how it, you know, becomes analytically, pedagogically, and maybe culturally useful for people and generations later, right? So thinking about myself specifically, this is one of the ways where I think about my own relationship to the research. And then the link to what I call historical grounded imagining is also related to sexuality and gender. But I want to say first that, you know, I sort of call this like collection of speculative, historical, historicist, really methods. I just call it this because I need it. I need to name it something, but it is not original to me in any way, right? So I'm, you know, especially influenced by Saidiya Hartman's work, and also Emma Perez's work around this. But thinking about the kinds of the violence done by particularly state-produced records and the limitations of that for the kind of historical knowledge we have. So, you know, as I said earlier, because archival collections are shaped by what people donate, and they're often, you know, people are donating things to reflect themselves, their families, their communities in ways that they think are respectable. And this is, you know, often cutting out gender and sexual non-normativity from our collective historical records. And we have all of these records that are produced by the state. And those records are really, you know, formed by heteronormativity and white supremacy. We get, you know, records of marital status, heteroreproductive familial relations, race, mm-hmm. and so on, right? So to take these things as sort of mere facts, right? Really unremarkable, uninteresting, and they're just facts. Doing that really reinscribes these historical subjects in, you know, ways of being and thinking of themselves that may not have been accurate to their experiences. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that the alternative is to say, well, we can't explore anything else because we don't know. We can't verify it in the same way that we would verify that someone was married, right? Mm-hmm. Or when they were born, which, by the way, when they were born, that's also something that can be mm-hmm. quite murky, right? So, you know, I knew that that didn't mean that this kind of sexual and gender diversity, the possibilities that did not exist in the history. And mm-hmm. I think confining ourselves to what's documented in archival collections, what's produced by the state, it limits that history to hetero and cis normativity. And as a result, it limits it, it's confining it to white supremacist ontological structures as well. So mm-hmm. what I do in the book is I intentionally imagine moments or scenarios that like push past the recorded archive to open up the possibility for gender transgression, for homosocial intimacy, and for homoerotic desire. I think homosociality ends up being sort of a one that maybe many people are can be comfortable with, as mm-hmm. long as we don't take it into desire. Sexual desire and intimacy, right? So particularly in the relationships between those who labored in the peddling economy, that's something that I want to highlight. And I'm not actually sort of pushing to claim particular historical mm-hmm. subjects as, you know, gay or lesbian or queer or some, this sort of, you know, particular way that we know today to link sexual identity with sexual desire and sexual activity. Mm. Because I also think that there can be problems with that, but I want it to be clear that I don't know mm-hmm. and that the not knowing is not a reason not to talk about it, but also that when you see when someone was married, that actually doesn't tell us anything about how they understood themselves, you know, who they were, what their intimate life was like, what the life of their desire was like in the world. We don't actually know that from a marriage record or the births of children. So I both want to open up this possibility for these kinds of queer histories and possibilities and to destabilize this assumption of heteronormativity just permeating every all of these different facets of historical actors that we are probably taking for granted, many of us.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. That was beautiful. I just reading your work and also folks like Hartman that you mentioned, I feel like you also seem to be proposing humility as not only a particular kind of ethic within the academy and one that's, you know, maybe not encouraged by the kind of hegemonic idealization mm-hmm. of the distant or otherwise objective, and I'm like using mega air quotes for objective yeah. academic, but also thinking about humility methodologically mm-hmm. in terms of, as you say, what we can know, what we can't know, and also that historically produced erasures, whether violently produced or otherwise, don't simply indicate historical absence, but mm-hmm. rather that we should be like sort of carefully, very carefully, but also like caringly open, mm-hmm. As you say, to many historical possibilities. So I think your care and your carefulness really does emerge. And I would direct mm-hmm. readers to the really important analyses of historical praxis that you provide, like including both the kind of deployments and critiques of recovery work within ethnic studies, mm-hmm. or you know, scavenger work within queer studies.
Thank you for that. That's really, I really appreciate that. Thank you.
Sure.
It was
Thank
something
you.
That I really, I mean, I, you know, I don't know. I I have to be open to the possibility that I get things wrong, that there's implications of the method that I may not have been aware of, that I might be uncomfortable with or might, you know, regret later on. But I did try to just, I did try to do it with care. So I appreciate that.
It shows. So I guess related to that point about sort of skirting with the disciplinarity, I'd love to talk next about the relationship of your research to its fields. So in addition to working within and against history's disciplinarity, you're also sort of reckoning with the margins of both Arab American studies and gender and sexuality studies. So, for instance, I really appreciated a moment in the book when you discuss how Arab and Swana regions and communities are considered rather uninteresting or belated subjects of queer theory. So I feel this very much in relation to working on Muslims in Islam in both queer and feminist critique in the global north, where they're either sort of considered these, again, these delayed subjects of queer and feminist theory, or they're represented sort of very statically in a kind of binary of imperialized subjects of modern Western heteronormativity versus authentic subjects of queer sexual past. So you remind us how this kind of marginalization speaks to queer theory's own investments in liberal modernity. So, and you're obviously thinking quite a bit with other thinkers of queer theory from post-colonial and Asian American traditions. So broadly, I'd love to invite you to talk about how your book and scholarly investment sort of rethinks the Arab in queer studies. And there's obviously a long genealogy of the Arab in queer studies, and also rethinks the queer and Arab American studies.
Yeah, I mean, the idea of a particular site geopolitically or subject being uninteresting or belated subjects. I was really moved by Kigoro Macharia's work I'm citing there in relation to queer studies, queer theory, and the African continent. And it does seem to me that this is what we are currently experiencing, both with regard to Muslims and Islam, as you mentioned, and also Arabs and Arab Americans. There is a kind of, even if unintentional, I think, kind of developmental model in queer studies, and you know, as it's anchored in North America and Europe, and I think particularly in the United States, that is linked to these ideas about, as you say, investments in modernity, right? That, and as a result, there becomes this kind of really narrow way to even be able to see a queer site, right? Or a queer figure that's not just worthy of scholarship, but something that becomes interesting beyond this kind of parochial understanding of, like, you know, oh, this is another example of this, right? In just this one spot. This is the Arab example. I think that was probably a reason why I did not know how sexuality was going to be in the project for a long time, quite frankly. I mean, if we look at, like, queer of color critique, scholars within queer of color critique have done a ton of work to challenge the whiteness of the subject in queer studies and queer theory in particular, right? And I still think that there's other kinds of ideas about development and modernity that unintentionally has seeped into some areas of queer of color critique, but in others, I think that there's also, like, a real interest in seeing, okay, what kind of additional assumptions or structures are being built in this new analysis. Where are we not looking, or where are we not thinking? So I still see queer of color critique as, like, the really expansive site of possibility for these kinds of of conversations, even if there it doesn't feel like there's really much of a investment or awareness in Arab and Muslim sites and subjects yet. I still think that the frameworks are there that will allow for a lot, but you know, maybe not without challenges or limitations that need to be dealt with, right? But to me, there's this thing. It's not like they're really separate. This kind of queer studies, Arab American studies paradigms that I'm trying to think about. In Arab American studies, I think that what we have in the field is a foundation of feminist scholarship and a foundation of women scholars who've really kept the eye on women, especially and gender to a certain extent, in terms of the knowledge that's been produced. And yet, a critical interrogation of heterosexuality and heteronormativity has been very hard to come by. And on top of that, I think that in a historical or historicist sense, it's been especially challenging. So I think what you get more often is really a more contemporary focus because of how the terms of Orientalism have shifted and the kind of civilizational kind of paradigm within Orientalism around sexuality and gender has shifted. And of course, now we have homonationalism. And I think it has facilitated more thinking about that. But still, it feels like it's uninteresting, right? Because it feels, I think, too... in terms of queer studies, it feels like it's outdated, right? Or like we've already moved beyond that and moved past that. And that these sites of the world, these sites, these communities can't provide anything more than an example of something that we already know. We've already proven that, which is something that I really struggled with in the book too, of just feeling like, well, we already know that sexuality is implicated in race. All of these other people have already shown that. And really trying to figure out why it's still worth talking about Arabs and Arab Americans. And I think the other thing that this question really reminded me of, and I don't know if this is what you were thinking about with it or not, but there's something about like the economy of interest in which Arab American and American Muslim studies circulate that feel still very much tied to the U.S.'s, like in a kind of national imaginary sense, understanding of 9/11, right? And so that there's, and I really noticed this with my own kind of like going on the job market and seeing jobs come up, that that felt like there was like this moment of interest, right? Because it felt relevant. But the relevance of that, I think particularly for Arab American studies, has not been sustained, right? That's not understood as like something that continues to be relevant. Because I think that it's not seen as something that can be applied to other contexts. So for me, I in graduate school worked with several people who are Asian American studies scholars and felt Asian American studies frameworks, among other ethnic studies frameworks, had a lot to offer me, right? But it is rare that I see that happening in reverse. And it's, this is not about a kind of, you know, competition of like nobody returns the favor, right? But I see time and time again that the theories that are produced out of Arab American studies, theories that are produced out of critical Muslim studies, are not taken seriously as things that are meaningful and need to be understood outside of those particular communities. And I feel like that also has the connection to this kind of uninteresting, belated modernity developmental thing happening within queer studies.
Absolutely. I'm snapping for our listeners. I could
go off on my soapbox.
I would love to have this conversation for another hour, yeah. But we're closing in on our time. So I'll move to our last question. Yeah. But I would also just add, for North Americanist or scholars working in North America, particularly doing queer color critique, your work, I'm thinking about sort of my syllabi, teaching ethnic studies, teaching, I just taught a class on race, sexuality in the state, that thinking outside of the kind of national model is also important, or the kind of productive model that you give us, that about how the governance and moralization of gender and sexuality are not just situated in relation to the kind of U.S. heteronormative state, but are also transnational and mobile, and you really sort of follow that kind of mobility. So I guess finally, I thought we could conclude the discussion by thinking about the kind of contemporary resonances of this project, which you've already sort of highlighted. So your book's historicization of Arab American race and sexuality is particularly timely and useful context for contemporary U.S. politics and the so-called culture wars. So you're a professor in Michigan, where there's recently a lot of media coverage of small communities of Arabs and Muslims mobilizing alongside right-wing white Christians against LGBTQ affirming policies, particularly though not only in relation to public education. So while these are obviously particularly situated events, how can Arab American histories complicate or speak to this moment? And I'm posing this question very openly, but I'm thinking about how your book provides us a kind of long historical arc for how state politics, community self-disciplining, and moral panics all intersect toward disciplining race and sexuality, and that this history has long included Arab Americans.
Yeah. I mean, I really wish we didn't have to have this question. It's just been so demoralizing to see this happen. But not just in Arab and Muslim communities, but in all kinds of communities. It is, however, I think important to remind ourselves and remind other people that this is rooted in white Christian nationalism, as you've mentioned, right? That this is where this move is coming from, is from these strategies, right? That's rooted in that particular politic. I think when it comes to talking about, you know, gender and sexuality, especially in terms of queer and trans issues, non-normativity, et cetera, you know, there is a tendency among people who don't feel directly affected by those issues to believe that it is the concern of queer and trans people, right? And so with regard to this, that it must just be the concern of queer and trans Arabs, right? But these kinds of politics affect how everyone is shaped in the community, right? So these ideas historically about peddlers being linked to a kind of deviant sexuality were used to malign people who, you know, were not peddlers, right? But also seem to be, in all other regards, upstanding normative citizens with regard to gender and sexuality, right? It's not something that stops at the you know, in Arab communities, the kind of this idea that your sexual and gender non-normativity is going to be a shield for you will only go so far. One, because that's always going to be tied to race. The racialization of Arabs is always going to be tied to this idea of sexual non-normativity, whether it be a kind of homoerotic deviance, so-called deviance, right? Or a kind of excessively oppressive or repressive sexuality that we're sort of living under now, right? And that this becomes in that the Orientalist frameworks that we have, this becomes linked to an excessive or exceptional patriarchy, and exceptionally submissive existence for women, right? So it's sutured together. So the access to normativity, the access to belonging, and in this regard, it's an access to belonging with Christian white supremacists who will instrumentalize our communities to get to this, you know, whatever it is that they're envisioning, right? Mm-hmm. But they are not envisioning safety for Muslims, safety for Arabs. They're not envisioning self-determination for any of these kinds of communities, right? So to think that this is just, quote unquote, going to affect or harm queer and trans people who supposedly, according to these folks, aren't even a part of our communities or don't get to be treated as human or whatever the thinking is, it's really short-sighted. And it won't serve them. I mean, you already see examples of this, of people aligning with these folks then saying, oh, that feels racist or Islamophobic. I don't know about that. Right. Mm-hmm. So it's incredibly alarming to see it happening in this way. And I hope that, enough people. I mean, there are a lot of people doing work around this, mm-hmm. right? And speaking about these connections and the trap of falling into these kinds of frameworks and thinking, right? And so mm-hmm. it's just something that we have to keep working on, and both on a national scale and on these smaller community levels.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. And that's certainly a hopeful note to end on. The work continues. So Charlotte, thank you so much for this conversation and for your tremendous work. And I encourage everyone to find a copy of Possible Histories, which is a gift to so many of our fields.
Thank you so much for having me. And thanks to all of you for listening.